Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Sherritt International Second Quarter 2019 Results Conference Call and Webcast. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Following management's presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone has any difficulties hearing the conference, please press star zero for assistance at any time. I would like to remind everyone that this conference call is being recorded today, Thursday, August 1st, 2019. I will now turn the presentation over to Joe Racanelli, Director of Investor Relations and Communications. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. We released our second quarter results last night after market close, and all of our disclosure materials, including MD&A, financial statements, and press release, are available from our website as well as on SEDAR. Before we begin, I'd like to point out that we will be making use of a presentation that is available from the IR section of our website. Today's discussion and presentation will include forward-looking statements, and I'd like to refer everyone to page two of the deck in the cautionary language and to the risk factors as well that are detailed in our annual information form that's been filed on SEDAR. With me are David Pathe, our CEO, Steve Wood, our Chief Operating Officer, and Andrew Snowden, our Chief Financial Officer. Each will provide some commentary on our second quarter results and performance. Following their discussion, we will have a Q&A session. With that, I'd like to now turn the call over to David Pathe, Sherritt's CEO.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Good morning, everyone. Thanks again for joining us this morning. I know it's a busy day in terms of earnings today, so I appreciate you taking the time. A busy quarter for us with lots of moving parts, both inside and outside the company, so we're going to try and shed some light and a bit more context around a number of those for you this morning before we take your questions. A few highlights from the quarter to start on page four of the presentation there. Obviously, we got our receivables deal with our Cuban partners ratified and have started to receive some payments under that. Andrew will provide a little more context and detail as to how that works. We saw strong production in our Moa joint venture following on from a much stronger Q1 compared to last year. We sustained that through Q2 and continue that. Despite higher production, though, financial results are impacted by severe volatility in the commodity prices. We'll provide a bit of context around that, but in particular, the year-over-year decline in cobalt prices was dramatic. I think we were down 60%-65% in cobalt price year-over-year, just as an example. We also, in the quarter, released a new 43-101 report. Steve will provide a little more context on that as well, but that shows us a path to significantly extend the mine life in our Moa joint venture, which is well aligned with our continuing belief that the nickel fundamentals over the longer term, despite near-term volatility here, are still solid, particularly for Class 1 nickel. Taking a look at the market, we've seen a number of headwinds in the commodity markets generally and for Sherritt in particular over the course of this year. We've seen dramatic commodity price volatility. I touched on the cobalt price, but we've seen a lot of ups and downs in nickel and cobalt over the last 12 or 18 months, driven in part by fears on the pace of global growth, fears of trade wars, tariffs impositions, and growth rates in China and elsewhere, and the potential impact that has on demand for base metals, and nickel and cobalt in particular is continuing to affect us. Sherritt in particular is affected by ongoing increasing of U.S. sanctions against Cuba. We saw Title III implemented and spoke about that in the first quarter. Over the second quarter, the U.S. has continued to ramp up pressure on Cuba. Other actions such as some sanctions against companies shipping goods in and out of Cuba. We saw the U.S. move to prohibit Americans from traveling to Cuba on cruise ships, for example, that is impacting Cuba's access to foreign reserves. These kind of glowing geopolitical and economic tensions continue to be an issue in markets generally and us in particular. Over on page seven, you can see what nickel and cobalt prices have done over the last 18 months or 12 months, I guess, in this graph. Nickel has been volatile, had a nice run-up, climbed about nearly 20% in the course of a week over in July. I'll touch on a number of factors on that at the moment, but it did reverse the fairly steady decline we saw in nickel prices over the second half of last year. Cobalt, as I mentioned, continued its decline and reached a 12-month low, about $12.43. I think we bottomed that out during the quarter. Looking at nickel volatility, there's a number of factors that are driving that. In some cases, they're working against one another. We did see continued strong stainless steel production. Stainless steel, despite the attention paid to batteries and battery metals and nickel demand for batteries over the last couple of years, stainless steel is still the single biggest driver of nickel demand, consuming about two-thirds of global nickel production, and that despite the overall concerns about economic activity and going on in the world, stainless steel production has held up pretty well. The news came out of Indonesia about a potential implementation of re-implementing the ban on the export of raw ore, which could have an impact on Chinese nickel pig iron production beginning in 22, caused a bit of optimism in the short term of the nickel price, and that we believe caused some short sellers that were speculating against the nickel price to cover some positions, and that drove some of the jump that we saw over the course of July. I think it remains to be seen how that nickel price, whether that jump that we saw in the nickel price can be sustained over the course of the year. It'll be very much affected by what happens to global growth and expectations of growth on the continuing discussions between China and the U.S. on global trade and tariffs, and whether or not any demand that comes out of this expected Indonesian ore ban can actually be sustained. But I think in the near term, we're expecting to see ongoing volatility in prices for our commodities. Just to give you a feel for a bit more of a context around how those changes in commodity price affect us, slide 9 there shows the movement in nickel and cobalt prices over the last few years, and the bars underneath depict the MOA JV's ability to generate EBITDA. You can see we had a strong year in 2018 on the back of high commodity prices, particularly in the first half of the year when cobalt got up as high as about $45 a pound and nickel moved north of 7, but fell off significantly in the second half of the year. Just to put the movement in context, in the first half of 2018, our nickel production and sales volumes were up about 20% over the same first half of 2018, but because of the significant decline in cobalt price and to some extent nickel price as well, despite the 20% higher sales volumes, our EBITDA in those businesses was off by about 75%. Just a quick look at the longer-term nickel market, and this is a graph we've used often on page 10, showing the global nickel inventories. The significant decline that began really in 16 and 17 and picked up speed in 18 has largely continued in 19, with analysts generally forecasting a market continuing to be in deficit, particularly with respect to Class 1 nickel, and that is without a significant impact yet of batteries. Battery demand as a portion of the overall nickel market or nickel demand is still only 2 or 3% of the nickel market. But battery demand growth has so far grown apace of most of the forecasts that are out there, and we continue to see those inventories come down in global inventories. We've seen this somewhat bizarre phenomenon over the course of the second half of last year where we've had simultaneously declining prices and declining global inventories. We don't believe that is sustainable over the long term, but the macro concerns and volatility are in some ways swamping those fundamentals. Steve's now going to touch on a few operational highlights before Andrew comes and talks about finances, and then I'll come back at the end and talk a bit about Block 10 before we take your questions.
Thanks, Dave, and good morning to everyone on the line. Before I speak on our operational highlights, I'd like to briefly comment on our health and safety improvement plan progress. We continue to see health and safety improvements across all of the operations as a result of the work that we've been doing over the last couple of years on visible felt leadership and fatal risk prevention. As well, in the quarter, we continue to increase our efforts in the field of process safety management, which will further improve our safety performance going forward. I will now turn to our production results, starting with the MOA joint venture on slide 12. On a 50% basis, MOA produced 3,969 tons of nickel and 415 tons of cobalt in Q2. That's up 6% and 7% respectively from last year's same quarter. The increased production was driven by a number of operational excellence initiatives that have been launched over the last 18 to 24 months, including the deployment of new mining equipment and the successful operation of the new slurry prep plant that was commissioned in the first quarter of this year. The new mining equipment has delivered a number of benefits, including improved ore access and reduced equipment downtime, and the new slurry prep plant has reduced haul distances while improving our ore screening and processing effectiveness. The operational momentum puts us firmly on track to achieve our production guidance targets for this year. And consistent with previous years, Q2's production was impacted by the annual maintenance shutdown of the refinery in Fort Saskatchewan that lasted approximately 10 days. The maintenance shutdown was completed on time and on budget, and equipment inspection resulted in no unplanned repairs or replacements. The NDCC in the quarter was $3.83 a pound of nickel. And that's up 168 from last year. Oh, sorry, up from 168 of last year. The increase was due to the 64% year-over-year decline in realized cobalt prices. And the higher fertilizer prices and higher sales volumes, coupled with the third-party feed costs in Q2, helped to mitigate the impact of our lower realized cobalt prices. I should point out that Q2's NDCC was lower by more than 15% from the NDCC of Q1 in 2019, which is $4.53 per pound. The quarter-over-year decline was indicative of more stable cobalt prices, and you will recall that the cobalt prices experienced a rapid decline in Q1 of this year, resulting in negative adjustments to provisionally priced contracts. And these adjustments increased the Q1 NDCC by 40 cents a pound. And because of the cobalt prices being fairly stable in Q2, our NDCC was largely unaffected by provisional pricing adjustments. I'll turn now to slide 13 and discuss our oil and gas highlights. We produced 4,420 barrels of oil per day in Cuba on a gross working interest basis in Q2. That marked a decline of approximately 6% from last year when we produced 4,689 barrels of oil per day. The decrease was due to the natural reservoir declines and was expected. And as also is to be expected, the decrease had a negative impact on unit costs. The unit costs in Cuba for Q2 were $19.93 per barrel, which is up from $16.10 per barrel for the same quarter of last year. And the unit costs were negatively impacted by the depreciation of the Canadian dollar relative to the U.S. dollar. And our labor expenses are denominated in U.S. dollars. Hence the impact. I'll now turn to the power division on slide 14. We produced 180 gigawatts of electricity in the quarter, down 12% from last year when we produced 204 gigawatts in the same period. The decline was largely due to reduced availability of the natural gas that we use to produce the electricity. And our unit operating costs in the quarter were $16.35, which was down 12% from the $18.57 of last year. The decrease was primarily due to our decision to limit operational spending to levels required to maintain certain plant operations as we continue to work with our Cuban partners to collect on our Cuban energy receivables. The impact of reduced spending more than offset the impact of lower sales volume and a weaker Canadian dollar in the quarter as as power business costs are generally denominated in U.S. currency. Finally, on slide 15, I'd like to review our 43-101 technical report that we submitted in the quarter on SEDAR. The details are available on SEDAR should you be looking for some, but I'll cover off a few of the highlights. The report was prepared for us by CSA Global and includes a number of noteworthy findings. First, the report confirmed that the mineral reserves estimates that we published in our annual information form were correct. Second, and most important, the report increased the mineral resources estimates by almost 80%. As Dave mentioned, this increase paves the way for us to extend the mine life beyond its current 15 years. And the increase in measured and indicated resources estimates was largely driven by the use of an economic cutoff grade that was marginally lower than the fixed cutoff grade that we use in our reserves and as currently mandated. There is work to be done in upgrading the resources estimates to the reserves category, but we're encouraged by the potential of extending the mine life at Moa well beyond 2033. That concludes my review of operational results, and I'll now turn it over to Andrew Snowden, our CFO, who will review our financial results in more detail. Andrew.
Great. Thanks, Steve, and good morning, everyone. So I have a few financial slides to cover today, and I wanted to start by walking through the Cuban overdue receivable agreement, which we announced was ratified back in around the middle of June. I mean, this agreement did take longer than we had anticipated to finalize, in large part because of the geopolitical developments that Dave discussed earlier and the impact that had on Cuba's access to foreign currency. Despite those difficult conditions, though, getting the agreement ratified is a testament to our Cuban partners' commitment to making good on their liabilities and an appreciation of the liquidity constraints that Sherritt's facing. Now, there are a lot of questions about the agreement since it was announced last month, and so I wanted to take a couple of minutes to explain the deal to everyone. And if you turn to slide 17, you can see the process for payments before the overdue receivable agreement was ratified. And I mean, in simple terms, I think what this slide really highlights is that there was limited integration between our joint ventures in Cuba. And despite the fact that the Moa JV transferred approximately $10 million in foreign currency into Cuba each month, our ability to collect receipts from Enagas was dependent on the allocation of foreign currency to Enagas by the Cuban government, given that Enagas does not generate any foreign currency of its own. Slide 18, though, shows the process with the overdue receivable agreement now in place. And as you can see from the slide, there's a lot more lines and arrows here, and so that just highlights how complex this agreement is. But ultimately, it results in increased integration between the Moa JV and Enagas, where some foreign currency generated by the Moa JV can now be utilized by Enagas. So this agreement has two main components. And the first consists of average payments of around $2.5 million US a month, which are made to Sherritt. And in simple terms, the Moa JV pays this $2.5 million a month to Sherritt on behalf of Enagas, and in return, Enagas transfers an equivalent amount in local currency to the Moa JV for use within Cuba. The second component of this agreement is tied to dividend distributions from the Moa JV. So once each partner receives a minimum threshold of $34 million in distributions for the year, Sherritt gets 100% of available distributions. So in other words, Sherritt will receive every dollar of available distributions from the Moa JV once $68 million has been distributed to both partners in 2019. At this point, and due to the commodity price environment we've experienced in the first part of the year, it's unlikely we'll reach this threshold in 2019. But this threshold is negotiated each year, and expect the threshold will be lower for 2020. Although this agreement will not resolve our overdue receivable issue by itself, it is an important step in repatriating some of the cash currently held at Enagas in Cuba. Just as a reminder as well, this agreement is effective for until $150 million US of overdue receivables are repaid under its terms. Turning now to slide 19, you can see the impact this overdue receivable agreement, or the contribution this agreement has had to our progress in collecting our receivables in Q2. And you can see on this slide that we received around $5.4 million US under this agreement during the quarter. The regular payments received from power, though, have continued to be slow, and that's linked to the geopolitical developments, which Dave referred to earlier, and we only received $6.5 million under regular payments from power during the quarter. The most significant factor impacting our receivables in Q2, though, was the receipt of around $20 million U.S. from our oil and gas business during the quarter. I should point out, though, and as you'll see in our press release and also on the banner in, on this slide, that this did include around $9 million U.S. in early payments on amounts that QPET was scheduled to pay to Sheraton Q3. So as a result of that, I am expecting limited oil and gas collections during Q3, and the overdue balance will likely increase as we approach September 30th. So turning now to slide 20, just wanted to make a few comments on our adjusted EBITDA for the quarter, and you can see from this slide, really the key contributors to the increase in our EBITDA from $1.2 million negative in Q1 to the $9.5 million we've reported in Q2. There were three key factors contributing to that increase. I mean, one was due to the higher realized cobalt prices, which you can see contributed around $5 million improvement. The main impact or the main driver behind that is really linked to the factors which Steve highlighted earlier, and it's a result of the fact that Q1 was impacted by the negative provisional pricing adjustments due to the rapid decline in cobalt during the first quarter. In addition, we did have higher revenues on fertilizer sales delivered in the quarter, and you'll recall these sales are generally recognized each year in May and October, and so this was the kind of spring fertilizer season deliveries where the revenue was recognized in Q2. And then the third key contributor was the lower operating costs, particularly at MOA, that were achieved during the quarter, which Steve alluded to earlier. These factors were partly offset by lower nickel and cobalt price volumes at MOA, which was due to the shutdown again that Steve referred to. So turning now to slide 21, this slide really just highlights the changes in our cash balance over the past 12 months or so. And you'll see from this slide that we ended the quarter with a consolidated cash position of $177 million, of which, as I think everyone's fully aware, $76 million of that is our share of cash which sits in Enagás and is currently sitting in Cuba. So our corporate cash and available cash to the share at corporate level is $101 million you see in dark blue on that slide at June 30th. During the quarter, we did receive good payments on our Cuban energy receipts and also some dividends from MOA, which positively impacted our cash balance during the quarter. But these factors were offset by around $16 million of interest costs, costs associated with our fertilizer business and our oil and power businesses. And this included Block 10 capital spending and costs associated with the annual shutdown at the Fort site. So all of those factors, in essence, offset the cash that came in from dividends and overdue receivables and kept our overall cash balance reasonably flat from Q1. Liquidity, though, does continue to be tight, and I will highlight in a couple of slides' time, and this was noted in our press release as well, around the implementation of austerity measures, which we implemented across the business during the quarter. So I'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. Before I do that, though, I wanted to briefly talk about the status of our credit facility and covenants, and you can see some details there included on slide 22. So as a reminder, we have a credit facility of $70 million, Canadian dollars, with a syndicate of local lenders here in Canada. Roughly $53 million of that facility is utilized, and you can see on the slide here that's utilized with an $8 million draw and approximately $45 million of letters of credit related to reclamation obligations on our oil business. And that leaves around $17 million undrawn, which you can see in the green highlighting on the slide there. So taking this undrawn amount into consideration, our minimum cash balance requirement of $100 million is reduced to $83 million at the end of the quarter, and this compares to our actual cash balance, excluding Enagás, of just over $100 million at June 30th. Although we were compliant with this minimum cash covenant at the end of Q2, we did need to seek relief from our syndicate on the minimum on the EBITDA and the EBITDA interest expense ratio covenants for Q2 and Q3, and that relief was received prior to June 30th. So you'll see on this slide, we've just highlighted that the EBITDA calculation has been reduced from $100 million to $70 million, and the interest coverage ratio from 1.75 to 1.35, and that's effective, as I mentioned, at June 30th and again at September. And so those changes ensured that we were compliant at June 30th on those two covenants. Just to quickly highlight as well, those covenants are not purely the EBITDA number that we report. There is a defined calculation under the credit facility, which dictates how those calculations are defined, and it does include certain interest income. So as I mentioned earlier, given our liquidity position, we did implement a number of austerity measures in Q2, and that included the deferral of non-critical spending, limited hiring, and elimination of discretionary spend. And slide 23 and 24 really will highlight some of the impacts of that austerity program. So first, just on slide 23, where we talk to administrative costs, as you can see from this slide, we reduced admin costs from Q1 by about $500,000, and that was in addition to sustaining the significant reductions which we achieved in 2018. This cost reduction was not as significant as initially planned, and that was due to increased legal fees incurred to manage risks associated with the implementation of Helms-Burton Title III back in May, which Dave referred to earlier. So finally, I just wanted to make a few comments on our updated guidance included on slide 24. These updates largely centered on capital spend and unit costs, both of which were driven by the austerity program I mentioned and also changes to the cobalt price assumptions embedded in our NDCC. And overall, production guidance for the year is largely unchanged. The one change we did make to production guidance, you'll see at the top here, relates to our oil business, where we lowered our networking interest production by about 200 barrels a day. And that change was really just a reflection of the sale of our interest in a natural gas field in Pakistan, which we closed in July. The Pakistan business produced immaterial margins for us, and so that sale will not impact our financial results going forward. I should point out, though, that our gross working interest production guidance for Cuba is unchanged, and we do remain on track to produce within that guidance. While production at the MOA JV was unchanged, our NDCC guidance at MOA did increase through the quarter, and we increased that to a range of 50 per pound of nickel, and that increase is purely due to the change in cobalt price. In the past, or in Q1, and we were assuming a cobalt price of $25 a pound. Embedded in these numbers now is a cobalt price of about $15 a pound. So that $10 decrease in cobalt is reflected in this new number, partly offset by some cost savings identified at MOA. We also did, as a result of austerity and deferral of capital spending, reduce our MOA JV CapEx guidance from $40 million US to $30 million US for the year. So you'll see that on this slide. And the final update just to highlight here is the unit cost updates we've made to oil, gas, and power during the quarter, which are meaningful updates, and they reflect our decisions around cost reductions and austerity due to a broad range of measures undertaken. And these measures are being undertaken as we work with our Cuban partners to continue to collect on our overdue receivables. So that concludes my remarks for today. I'll turn the call back to David for an update on Block 10.
Good. All right. Thanks, Andrew. Just before we get to your questions, then, I didn't want to just give you a quick sense of where we are at now on Block 10. A couple of slides here on 26 and 27. I'm just going to focus briefly really on the diagram on slide 27 that shows a model cross-section of what it is we're drilling through. Those of you who have been following this for the last few quarters know that this has been a challenging hole for us to drill. We've encountered some difficult geology that we haven't really seen before, despite our 200-plus holes that we've drilled in Cuba over the last 20 or 25 years. You'll recall at the end of the first quarter, when we last really had a chance to talk about this, looking at that graph on page 27, that we were having some issues getting through the geological zone between the upper and lower reservoirs. So the green areas, the lighter green at the top represents the upper reservoir sheets, and the darker green represents the lower reservoir sheets, which is really our target zone. And that vertical black line, or nearly vertical black line, on the right-hand side of the graph represents the trajectory of the wellbore that was drilled by us from a jack out in the bay 20 years ago into that lower reservoir where we had that oil strike, and we're targeting that same zone. For the last couple of quarters, our issues have been actually traversing the brown and beige areas, the Constancia and the Vega Alta, between the two reservoirs, where wellbore instability was causing us issues and having us to back up and rethink our strategy of getting through that. Drilling did recommence in the second quarter, and we have now successfully traversed those zones that were causing us the instability in the past. And they've been successfully cased, so that instability is now safely protected behind the steel casing. And we were late in the quarter able to resume drilling down into the reservoir. That shows us now actually probably one sheet away from the target sheet. We are hoping to be able to drill now through on into those three or four reservoirs, and in the coming weeks here should finally be able to come back and report to you on what we're finding as we get into the reservoir. That is where we stand at the moment. It has been a challenging hole and a more drawn-out process than certainly we were anticipating when we embarked on this this drilling campaign. But we are now, I think, through the worst of what we had to traverse, and should hopefully be in a position to have some results soon. Just to summarize where we are overall, it's obviously been a difficult time for us, both from a macro condition and from the economic conditions in Cuba. But the second quarter marked further progress on the items that are within our control. We do anticipate continued volatility and uncertainty from a geopolitical and a market perspective, and are trying to manage our business conservatively in the face of that. We continue to work closely with our Cuban partners to manage our liquidity issues, and there's a tremendous amount of goodwill there, but it is a difficult time in Cuba, unquestionably. Longer term, we still believe that the nickel market, particularly for Class 1 nickel, is an area of promise in the future, and we believe that ultimately we are well positioned to take advantage of that. And our focus right now is in dealing with these difficult times that we face at the moment, and to be able to see the benefit of that in the future. With that, we will take your questions. Operator, are there any questions?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. We will now pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Greg Barnes from PD Securities. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you, Andrew. I was just a little surprised by the $13.5 million dividend from Moa in the quarter. I'm surprised that was made, given where nickel prices were and have been over the last 6 months or so. I know they're up recently, but they were lower.
So Moa, if you recall, and I think I can't remember whether this was a comment I made at Q1 or at year-end, but Moa did end the year with a with a slightly higher cash balance than we typically would hold at Moa. And through the first quarter, Moa continued to hold on to some of that cash, just given the volatility in cobalt prices. But as nickel prices started to stabilize and we saw a little bit of strengthening there, we did feel comfortable dividending out some of the cash that was being held at Moa up to the shareholders. So that was really the driver behind that.
And how do you see that evolving over the next 6 months or so? I know it's dependent on nickel prices, but cobalt prices are way down. So how's the balance going to work there, in your view?
look, I mean, it's difficult to sit here and feel confident that we'll be receiving dividends each quarter from MOA because it clearly is dependent on the commodity price environment. I mean, as Steve mentioned, you know, production is strong, and we're very happy with how production's going. You know, the rule of thumb that I think I shared at, again, I can't recall whether this was Q1 or year end, is you know, if a nickel price, and particularly kind of where cobalt is now, nickel price of above $6, we should be seeing dividends out of MOA. So where nickel is today, I would expect that we will continue to see dividends through the balance of the year. But as you highlighted, Greg, it's difficult to predict exactly what those dividends would be.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Tony Robson from Global Mining Research. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Gentlemen, good morning, and thank you for taking my question. I guess a follow-up to Andrew. Andrew, could you give us a little bit more color on the $70 million plus of cash of your $177 million total held in Cuba, as an adjunct to that, and then how sort of easy it is to get out or not, and it goes to your point about leaving cash in MOA. And secondly, following that, your debt repayment schedules, if you could remind us of that, please. I see your 8% senior unsecured debentures are due in 2021. That's about $200 million. When in 21, please? And is there any chunky amounts of debt due prior to that? Thank you.
Okay, well, no, thanks for the question. I mean, on the debt reschedule payments, so you're right, our first debenture maturity is due in 2021, and that's November of that year, so it's late 21. You know, prior to that, there's no other significant amount due. The only item that we do renew on an annual basis, as you'll see in our disclosure, is our syndicated revolving credit facility, which we currently utilize. We've currently drawn about $8 million on that, and then utilize a letter of credit on that. So that's currently been utilized by about $53 million. The expiry of that facility is currently April of 2020, but that is a facility which we renew each year and haven't had any issues renewing in the past. Just addressing your first question about the kind of $70, $75 million in Enagas. So I'm not sure if you're on our Q1 call. We went into a little bit of detail there, but in short, we do, you know, in our financial results, consolidate a third of Enagas, and that third represents our ownership interest in the Enagas business. And Enagas, you know, currently sits on around, you know, just over $200 million of Cuban cash in its Cuban bank account. And so, as part of our, you know, accounting processes, we do consolidate and include on our balance sheet, you know, one third, which is, you know, that $70 million of Enagas cash. I mean, that cash is in Cuba, and it's not readily accessible by Sherritt or at the Sherritt corporate level. And that's really part and parcel of the overdue receivable issue that we talk to. In reality, Enagas should not be sitting on that amount of cash. That cash should be transferred to Sherritt. But because of foreign currency constraints within Cuba, Enagas has not been able to transfer that cash to Sherritt of late, and the overdue receivable deal we talked about is in part a solution to try and resolve that issue.
Okay, great. Thank you for refreshing my memory there. Appreciate it.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star one on your telephone keypad to ask a question. Your next question comes from the line of Matt Farewell from Imperial Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, good morning. I guess I want to ask about the austerity measures. You've announced them. There hasn't been a large impact on admin expense. However, you're still in kind of an undefined point with the oil and gas business. If you know, what kind of changes could a go or no go decision on Block 10 affect your admin expense, perhaps in the 2020 timeframe?
Yeah, so some of the austerity measures that you've seen, Matt, are reflected in the costs, and Andrew mentioned that that was offset by some incremental legal spend in the quarter related to Title III. Some of that is also reflected in the changes to the guidance for the second half of the year in terms of reductions in costs in the oil and the power business, and the reduction in capital at the MOA joint venture. And some of the offsets to the increase in guidance on net direct cash cost that are not as great as the proportionate impact of the decline in the cobalt price and the effect of the byproduct credit. With respect to your question on potential impact of Block 10 and go or no go, that will turn on obviously what success we can show once we finish the drilling of this campaign. The ideal scenario will be that we in the coming weeks here have a successful oil hit, and we'll put that well on production, and frankly we'll run it for several months to see how it production stands up and what the decline rate looks like. In the absence of that, it does play into our conversations with our Cuban partners around collections. Obviously, in the scenario where there is not a success in Block 10, that would be the catalyst for a look at what the cost structure of our oil business is going forward in terms of the needs of the oil business in the absence of a Block 10 success.
Got it. Great. And on the syndicated revolving credit facility, you obtained certain waivers from the lenders for two quarters buying you some time. You have a fairly substantial cash balance. How important is it to keep this facility rather than, cash collateralize the letter of credit and simply repay the balance? What's the thinking behind keeping this facility, and what kind of flexibility does it provide you?
Pretty much exactly that. It gives us added flexibility in our liquidity, because in the absence of that facility, the biggest impact would be having to cash collateralize the letters of credit that are currently outstanding for asset reclamation obligations. Our sort of cash in Canada balance is just over the $100 million mark right now. And in the absence of the credit facility, we'd be down $8 million in the repayment and another $40-odd million to collateralize the reclamation obligations, and so that would leave us 50 odd million bucks, and we've got 46 million a year in interest expense, so it would have a fairly significant impact on our ability to maintain liquidity and see ourselves through to 2021.
I guess my point is the minimum liquidity covenant in this facility is really what's restricting your liquidity. And maybe this is something that the lenders will provide some flexibility around as well. But I don't see the net result of repaying this facility being much different than the liquidity that you have today, taking into account that minimum liquidity covenant of $100 million.
Yeah, the impact is the same. Maybe when you net that out. You can see what our kind of true net liquidity is after the reclamation obligation if we were forced to cash collateralize that.
Right. Okay, great. Last question on the MOA cash balance. You indicated that there was, a higher than average cash balance that allowed for the MOA dividend. What kind of level is a cash balance that is kind of a minimum amount that you would need at MOA just to for working capital purposes, et cetera? Would it be at this range now around $48 million, or would it be a little bit lower than that?
Yeah, so we a couple of factors that drive that. I mean, one is in agreement with the Cuban government, we have agreed that MOA will ensure it has available a minimum of $60 million. Of available liquidity. $45 million of that is provided by their access to a working capital facility. And so their actual minimum cash balance they need is only kind of around, $15 million, $15 to $20 million. The other factor that kind of drives into that is just looking forward at the timing of capital spending to, obviously the goal is not to relieve MOA of all the cash it has, and then when capital may be required, it doesn't have the cash to be able to meet those capital requirements and have to draw down on its credit facility. So there is a judgment call made based on the forecasts, which then results in a cash number that's normally higher than that kind of $15 million. But right now, I think MOA does have some available cash, and I expect through the course of the year we will see some incremental dividends coming from MOA, as I mentioned earlier.
Your next question comes from the line of Tony Robson from Global Mining Research. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Apologies for coming back again. Actually, David, I think you answered a lot of my question regarding Block 10 production, assuming success. Assuming success, will you be following up with further production wells, and what sort of time frame, assuming all goes well, would you see before we'd actually hit sustainable production levels? Are we talking, is that as late as 2021 or 22, or could you drill some new wells in the short term, cash permitting, of course, to pick up that production rate? Thank you.
Yeah, Tony, your quick
sort of cash permitting qualifier is really the driving factor on that. Assuming success and that we can put a well on production in the coming weeks here and run it in rough terms for the balance of this year, in an ideal scenario, there would be a second, then a well drilled in 2020. The timing of that, just some work to be done to plan how that would be done based on all the learnings over the course of drilling this well so that we optimize the drilling plan for the second well. That'll also obviously be very much tied to the pace of receipts in the oil business, because our objective for the oil business is that it be able to support itself from a cash perspective rather than cash coming off the balance sheet to support further drilling. The other opportunity we'll be looking at is, if we have a successful well here, as we've talked about the last few quarters, and we haven't been able to do much on beyond some expressions of interest until we have some technical data and some track record of collections in the oil business, is the potential to bring in a partner that would fund some capital spending for incremental drilling in exchange for an equity interest in the block to be determined. So once we can actually show people some production data and some reservoir pressure data, we think there'll be an opportunity to have some of those conversations over the balance of this year and into next year that could be an alternative way of funding some development. But at the moment, in our liquidity position, in the absence of some improvement in collections on those overdue receivables or a third-party source of capital, there won't be a lot of it incremental capital spent. Ultimately, we do think this block has the potential to support a significantly sized oil business, which is why we've made the investment in it, given the cumulative of knowledge and infrastructure that we have in Cuba and the timing over the expiry of our other blocks. But beyond proving up the concept with this well, our ability to develop that will be dependent on finding a fresh source of cash.
Okay, understood, and thank you for the answer.
There's no further questions at this time. I will now turn the call back over to David Pathe for closing remarks.
All right. Well, just to thank you once again for taking the time to join us this morning. As you see, there is a lot going on. We are all around. To the extent you have other questions and interest as you work through this, or anything we can do to help over the quarter. Otherwise, we will speak to you all again in October with our Q3 release. Until then, enjoy the rest of summer. Thanks, everyone.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.